Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present ACLU attorney Melissa Goodman, who explains why her group is challenging President Obama's continued use of warrantless surveillance of Americans' overseas phone calls and email. Marianne Hitt of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, who talks about her group's efforts to end America's dangerous dependence on coal. And Brian Miller with United for a Fair Economy, who discusses his group's Tax Fairness Pledge campaign, which is working to end the Bush-era tax cuts benefiting the wealthiest Americans. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Los Angeles Times reports the Obama administration is in talks with the Indonesian military to renew training for the elite Kopassus Special Forces Unit. Kopassus has been implicated in human rights abuses since its creation in the 1950s. More recently, it has been implicated in abuses against student pro-democracy activists, kidnappings and murder on a genocidal scale in East Timor and West Papua. No Kopassus officer has ever been indicted for human rights abuses. The U.S. offer to train Kopassus officers comes as the Pentagon is ramping up counter-terrorist activity in Indonesia and Southeast Asia to fight violent Islamic insurgents who claimed responsibility for bombings in Bali and Jakarta. Any U.S.-funded training of the elite unit would have to conform with the 1997 law authored by Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, banning American aid to foreign militaries facing accusations of human rights abuses unless alleged abusers are brought to justice. Leahy, chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee's Subcommittee on Foreign Operations, insisted, "For the United States to resume military aid, Kopassus needs to change. Indonesian military officers who violated human rights cannot continue to serve in the military." In early April, the World Bank approved a $3 billion loan to build a massive 4,800-kilowatt coal power plant in northern South Africa. If constructed, the controversial power plant would be the first built in South Africa in 15 years. Several donor countries, including the United States, Britain, the Netherlands, and Norway, abstained on the loan sought by South Africa. The state-run utility Eskom Holdings will build the power plant once all the financing is in place. The new coal complex will emit over 25 tons of carbon dioxide annually into the air. According to the Interpress Service, community activists in South Africa attempted to enlist the Obama administration to oppose the loan. The U.S. Treasury did outline a series of concerns about the loan, but refused to actively oppose it. The World Bank defends the loan as an investment in future energy security in Africa's most affluent country and create jobs to help the poor. Two South African community groups, Groundwork and Earthlife Africa, filed a complaint against the World Bank to stop the project on behalf of citizens who will suffer from coal plant emissions. America's leading environmental groups went to Copenhagen last December to participate in climate change talks, but apparently lobbied instead for policies that will ultimately lead to unchecked global warming. Critics are asking why these environmental organizations dismissed what would be real solutions as unworkable or unrealistic. Historically, environmental groups were funded largely by their members and wealthy individuals, and their goal was singly focused, protecting the environment. According to The Nation magazine, starting in 1981, Jay Hare, president of the National Wildlife Federation, began to accept money from the world's worst polluters. This initiated a system that awarded these corporate funders points for environmental stewardship, with Hare claiming the companies wanted to right their wrongs. Shell Oil and British Petroleum saw it as reputation insurance. As other environmental groups' funding withered, they too began to accept corporate dollars. The Sierra Club endorsed the makers of Clorox bleach for their green household cleaners and accepted a percentage of the sales without confirming the company's claims that its GreenWorks product line is eco-friendly. Critics are calling this now 20-plus-year financial arrangement between eco-groups and big polluters ClimateGate and carbon laundering. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In July 2008, President Bush signed into law an amended version of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that granted sweeping new powers to the executive branch, allowing wholesale or dragnet collection of America's overseas phone calls and email. The measure, approved by the Democratic-controlled Congress, also provided retroactive immunity to telephone companies that participated in Mr. Bush's warrantless wiretap program. During his presidential campaign, Barack Obama strongly criticized the Bush administration's surveillance program that operated without judicial oversight. But once in office, he adopted many elements of his predecessor's spy program. In 2008, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the amended FISA legislation on behalf of journalists, defense lawyers, and human rights workers. The plaintiffs believe the new FISA law compromised their ability to perform work requiring confidential communications with their sources and clients. When a lower court dismissed their case in August 2009, the ACLU appealed the ruling and argued for reinstatement of the lawsuit before a New York federal appeals court on April 16th. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with ACLU staff attorney Melissa Goodman, who explains why her group is challenging President Obama's continued use of warrantless surveillance of Americans' overseas phone calls and email.
First of all, I will say that, you know, the law really does impact a lot of people, most people who make international telephone calls, receive international telephone calls, or, you know, send emails internationally. But our plaintiffs in particular are people who, as part of their job, have some sort of duty, for some people, ethical duties, for example, lawyers, to safeguard the confidentiality of their communications. And our plaintiffs are groups of people that very routinely communicate with people abroad about sensitive matters, sensitive foreign intelligence matters, or things related to stories about terrorism or stories about particular regions in the world where we think it's quite likely that the government is intercepting kind of communications en masse. For example, you know, all calls between Pakistan and the United States or Afghanistan and the United States. Our plaintiffs are people who routinely speak to people who we, you know, strongly suspect are being monitored and who are impacted in special ways by the law and have been forced really because of the law, because they can no longer promise confidentiality. For example, journalists can't promise confidentiality to their sources, lawyers can't promise confidentiality to their clients, have been really forced to take really burdensome and costly measures to protect the confidentiality of their communications, sometimes taking long trips abroad. And this is a serious and real concern for lawyers out there who, you know, sometimes who represent terrorism suspects or their family members, for journalists who are covering, you know, issues in the Middle East or in other countries that are of foreign intelligence interest, you know, Colombia, Venezuela, Russia, you know, the list can go on and on. Now their communications are seriously at risk. And our theory all along has been twofold. One, they are people who, you know, have a reasonable fear that their communications are being intercepted, and technically that's usually enough to get you into court to complain about a law. And the other basis was that they've already had to take these costly and burdensome measures. They've already suffered a concrete injury because of the law. So we've been arguing all along that they have a right to come to court to challenge the constitutionality of the law.
There was a court decision in August of last year that dismissed your original case, the case against the revised FISA law that the Obama administration is using right now to surveil Americans, right?
That's right. Unfortunately, a lower court judge, a federal district court judge, agreed with the government. The government has been making an argument here in this case, and really an argument it's been making throughout this entire history of challenges to the warrantless wiretapping programs or statutes. They've been making this argument that unless you can show for sure that you've been wiretapped, you have no right to come to court. But the problem with that argument is that foreign intelligence surveillance, the kind of surveillance we're talking about here, happens entirely in secret, and it is extremely unlikely that people who have been monitored under this law, whether or not they've been targeted or they've simply talked to people who have been targeted, they will likely never, ever know that they have been monitored. So, you know, the problem with the government's theory of who can come into court is that it really creates a catch-22. It essentially means that no one can come to court to challenge this law, and that's what we've been arguing about now in the Court of Appeals. We've appealed the lower court's ruling and have been asking the appeals court to reinstate the case and to find that we have legally what's called standing, a right to come into court and challenge the law.
Melissa, even if this court does reinstate your case, doesn't mean you're going to win the case. So are there other options? For instance, can Congress intervene here and revise the FISA laws even further to protect Americans' privacy and to make sure there's checks and balances?
Very good point. It's very true. If we make it past this hurdle in the case, it doesn't mean that we win everything. It just means that we get to go back and have a chance to argue about whether the law itself is unconstitutional. Though I'm very, very secure in the fact that we're right on that issue. The program and the statute lacks all of the normal safeguards that you have about a wiretapping statute. There's no suspicion. There's no individualized review by a court. There's no real oversight by a court. But all that said, it is certainly true that Congress could do something to fix the problem. In fact, this law is not a permanent law. It's a law that expires in 2012, and I think it's extremely important for people to pay attention to this issue and to, you know, keep the issue on the radar of their representatives, congresspeople, because it's an issue that the congresspeople are in the next, you know, year or two are going to have to start thinking about again and weighing in on. And one of the hopes is that we learn a lot more about how the law is actually being used, and, you know, we can make an informed decision about whether the law was even necessary in the first place or whether it's working. But Congress absolutely could repeal this law and return to the original system, which really had always worked in the first place.
That was ACLU staff attorney Melissa Goodman. For more information on the group's FISA lawsuit, contact them at area code 202-457-0800 or visit their website at aclu.org. The explosion earlier this month at the Big Branch mine owned by Massey Energy in southern West Virginia, which claimed the lives of 29 miners, the worst mining disaster in almost 40 years, has drawn attention to the dangers of coal production. But mining coal is just the start of a long list of dangers and destructive impacts on the land, water, air, and human health, both at the site of extraction and for those downwind of the coal-fired electricity plants. Burning coal produces at least 45% of America's electricity and 30% of the emissions in the U.S., which cause global warming. The Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign was motivated by the Bush-Cheney administration's advocacy for the construction of over 100 new coal plants to provide energy rather than moving toward renewables and energy efficiency, which Vice President Cheney famously declared a meaningless lifestyle choice. In the week commemorating the 40th anniversary of Earth Day on April 22nd, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Marianne Hitt, director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. She spoke about the successes the campaign has achieved thus far and the challenges which remain.
The coal campaign at the Sierra Club started as a very small effort back around 2002 with some activists in the Midwest who started seeing proposals pop up for new coal plants in their backyards. And it was very much a volunteer, grassroots-driven effort. And around that same time, just soon after, Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force proposed 150 new coal plants all across the country. And so the Sierra Club's small Midwestern coal campaign grew to a national effort, decided to take on all 150 of these proposed coal-fired power plants. And we have done that work with lots and lots of partner organizations and grassroots allies all across the country for many years, and I'm very proud to say that we now have defeated 128 of those proposed coal-fired power plants.
So can the proponents of those 128 plants you stopped make a few changes and come back again?
Well, the 128 coal plants we have defeated are likely gone for good. Now, if there's always, I suppose, a remote chance that one of them could pop back up again, but developers have dropped the permit applications, they've walked away from the projects, and those proposals are dead. And for those that we haven't been able to defeat, we continue fighting as long as we can until we feel like there really is no more chance of stopping it. Some have gone, you know, are under construction, and others we continue to fight to this day, but the rush to build new coal plants is quickly coming to an end. And the reason that we made that such a priority was because if you think about one coal-fired power plant, it's a massive source of global warming pollution, of mercury pollution, of toxic coal ash, which is what's left over after you burn coal, and a huge new consumer of coal that's mined using destructive techniques like mountaintop removal. So every single one of these has been a huge priority fight for us, and those that are still viable proposals, we're still fighting.
Did you use a variety of strategies or a one-size-fits-all magic bullet to stop them?
We used a wide variety of strategies. One of the things I think that has made us successful is that every single one of these proposed coal plants, if you think about it, it's like an incinerator or any other sort of big facility that is proposed in your community. The conditions are different. You have a different developer, you have different state regulators, you have a different community, and so every one of these is like a sort of massive campaign in and of itself. And so we have attorneys that we work with who were involved in the permitting process and challenging permits that we thought should not be issued. We had grassroots activists, volunteers involved in every one of these fights. A lot of times we reached out to political leaders like governors and really tried to persuade them that coal was not the right direction for the energy future of their state. And in different things worked in different places. In, some states like Kansas and Florida, the governors decided that building a new coal plant was not the right energy direction for their state. In other places, the permits did not stand up to a legal challenge, and in other places it was the local community that just really managed to stop the project because they really didn't want this in their backyard. Coal produces about 45% of our electricity and about 30% of our global warming pollution. It's our single biggest source, not only of global warming pollution, but also mercury pollution. It's the source of soot and smog pollution that causes tens of thousands of premature deaths and heart attacks and hospitalizations every year. And so the Sierra Club's coal campaign is not only trying to stop the construction of new coal-fired power plants, but we are actually trying to solve the problems that coal is causing along the whole life cycle, from mining and techniques like mountaintop removal to the burning of coal and all the pollution associated with it to the toxic coal ash that's left over after you've burned coal.
Mary Ann Hitt, if you stopped all these coal plants that would have produced so much electricity, then what, if anything, is being built instead? I've had so many conversations lately with people who say, even environmentalists, some, who say we need to build nuclear plants to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
There are places where we have stopped coal plants where they have instead pursued wind development, places where they are instead pursuing solar, and in places they are pursuing natural gas as an alternative, which obviously is, it's a fossil fuel that's far cleaner than coal, but it's still a fossil fuel, and there's still pollution associated with the extraction and with burning it. So there definitely are very viable alternatives, and one of the things that we have seen is as long as we have this amount of coal-fired power in our baseload capacity, in our energy mix in this country, there's really not that much market share for clean energy because we really, through energy efficiency, we have managed to really bring the demand for electricity in this country under control in recent years. And so opening up the market share for clean energy is going to involve transitioning away from coal. And everywhere that, we've been involved in stopping a coal plant, we have seen time and time again that renewable energy can come in and fill the breach. So it is a long way to go in this country until we are getting the majority of our power from clean forms of energy. But we think through the work we're doing in the coal campaign and working with our partners across the country, we're starting to head things in the right direction.
Is it true that of the 128 plants you've stopped, nobody's talking about substituting a nuke plant?
Not to my knowledge, and that may be because nuclear power is a very expensive proposition, and a lot of these coal plants were eventually defeated because they, in and of themselves, were pretty expensive, and they ultimately couldn't get their financing together. But that's definitely something that I think is a real possibility given the politics right around nuclear power right now.
That was Mary Ann Hitt of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. For state-by-state information about the group's efforts challenging the nation's continuing dependence on coal, visit the organization's website at sierraclub.org/coal. As the American people struggled to recover from the depths of the worst recession to hit the country since the Great Depression, Congress will soon start debating what to do with President George W. Bush's tax cuts for the nation's wealthiest citizens. By the end of 2010, the tax cuts, signed into law by Bush in 2001 and 2003, gave the nation's top 5% wealthiest citizens a total of $980 billion in tax breaks. Democratic leaders in Congress say the Bush tax cuts, set to expire at the end of 2010, will end for the wealthiest Americans, but will remain in place for couples earning less than $250,000 and individuals earning less than $200,000. Republicans predictably oppose ending tax cuts for the wealthy, warning that raising taxes on the rich coming out of a recession will diminish job creation and slow the recovery. The revenue expected from ending the tax cuts on the wealthy are estimated to total $675 billion through 2020. The group United for a Fair Economy is working with 700 U.S. millionaires who are calling for an end to the Bush tax breaks, to which they've been the prime beneficiaries. These wealthy business leaders and individuals have formed the Responsible Wealth Network, which fights for tax fairness and has campaigned to stop the proposed permanent repeal of the federal estate tax. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Brian Miller, executive director of United for a Fair Economy, who talks about his group's tax fairness pledge campaign, which is working to end the Bush tax cuts.
Right now, we're up to about 700 business leaders and high wealth individuals who are part of the network. We just started our tax fairness pledge a couple of, about 3-4 weeks ago, and we're up to 75 people with net worth of $1 million or more, 75 millionaires, who've basically taken this pledge, and in doing so, what they're doing is they're calculating how much they saved under the Bush tax cuts, and they're pledging to give that money away to organizations that are working for economic justice and progressive tax policy, and in many cases to reverse those very same cuts, which is sort of a poetic justice the way you look when you look at it. It's actually quite a powerful statement that they're making.
So tell us about the Bush tax cuts. The Bush tax cuts, as I read about it, they were implemented in 2001 and 2003, and it involved a lot of money. It's actually the reason we have had such large deficits in the country for over the last bunch of years.
Well, the Bush tax cuts are really, you're talking about three different set of tax policies that were reduced, the first one of which being income taxes. And, of course, that's the one everyone's familiar with, you know, that the income tax rates were cut across the board. However, the bulk of those benefits went to the highest income households. But there's two other elements that are really important to note about the Bush tax cuts is that they also dramatically reduced dividend taxes and capital gains taxes, are the tax rate on capital gains and dividends. And most Americans don't know about this because most Americans don't have a whole lot of capital gains and dividends, and they never really experienced this tax system. And what we're really talking about here is that it's investment income. And right now, the top income tax rate on income that you earn by going to a job and working like most Americans do is 35%. Granted, you have to make an awful lot to get to that 35% rate. It's like $372,000. But the top rate for unearned income, meaning you've got millions and millions of dollars sitting in a bank earning interest or sitting in investments and getting paid in dividends and whatever, the top rate on that is 15%, which means if you're making money by having money make more money, you're going to pay 15% top rate. If you're making money by going to work and producing stuff, and, you know, sweat equity and logging up frequent flyer miles, whatever, you're going to pay 35%. And that is a terribly misplaced set of priorities for a country that supposedly values work. And then the third set of tax policies that the Bush rolled back is, of course, the estate tax. And that, of course, you know, you're talking about something that just so blatantly impacts the wealthiest of the wealthy in this country. You have to basically pass on an estate of 3.5 million or 7 million for a couple to even be eligible to pay it. And the Bush administration had significantly reduced, rolled back that Bush tax cut to the 2009 levels. As of 2010, it's completely gone. Well, not completely gone because now people have to pay capital gains taxes. But again, it's scheduled to revert back to the pre-Bush levels in 2011. And all of these cuts that I just talked about are scheduled to revert back to the pre-Bush levels at the beginning of 2011. And so there's going to be a big debate in Congress about what to do. And the Obama administration rightly is calling for preserving the cuts that benefit middle-income families but allowing and low-income families, but allowing the cuts that went to the wealthiest households to expire and revert to their pre-Bush levels. Now, we'd go further than Obama has done because we have some differences of opinion. We think it needs to be stronger, but it's certainly a step in the right direction and it's the right idea.
Brian, I wanted to just check back for a little bit of historical context. Before Ronald Reagan came into office, what was the highest tax rate for wealthy individuals? You said a moment ago it was now 35% for earned income and 15% for unearned income. But since Reagan, it's really bounced down quite a bit, right?
Oh, yes. It was upwards of 70% in those days. It got reduced significantly over the years. In fairness, though, that 70%, there were a lot of exemptions that are also gone now. But even if you look at effective tax rate, it's gone down dramatically for the top income earners through the Clinton era and into the Bush era. A lot of the ideology that this was sold under was this whole trickle-down concept. You know, if we cut taxes for the wealthy, they're going to create jobs and we're all going to benefit, right? And what we've seen instead is stagnant wages for the last 30-plus years for average Americans, while the wealthy have become fabulously wealthy. And instead of a broadly shared prosperity, instead of trickle-down, what we've gotten is a mounting national deficit, underfunded services, and vast disparities of income between the haves and the have-nots. That's not what made this country strong. Our country was strongest economically in those post-war years, 40s, 50s, 60s, when we had very high tax rates on the wealthy, when we really pumped a lot of money into, you know, basically investing and building the nation's infrastructure.
That was Brian Miller, Executive Director of United for a Fair Economy. Contact the group by calling area code 617-423-2148 or visit their website at faireconomy.org, where you can use their online tax break calculator to find out how the Bush tax cuts affect you. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.